why is the ordeal a part of the process? Why doesn't Krishna just simply make it easy? I mean, do you ever ask that question? Or easier? Please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Guten Morgen. Why is the ordeal necessary? Or is the ordeal necessary? Yes.
Anything that comes very easily, we don't take for its value, we take it for granted.
But what happens if we promise Krishna, okay, if you give it to me without an ordeal, then I promise I'll take it very seriously.
It's a post-dated check. Huh? Prabhupada always said it's a
post-dated
check.
No, I'll promise right now. But why is the ordeal necessary? I mean, not that you're not correct.
So it chant with feeling. That's
what Maharaj's
point, that he actually chanted it from that. Yeah. We become aware of what is inside of our impurities, and then we cry out maybe more sincerely, connect ourselves.
Yeah, I want to hear more thoughts on this point. Why is an ordeal necessary? And if it is, why?
Love necessitates some ordeal. True love. We show our sincerity by going through the hard times and intensify the devotion.
Couldn't think of Krishna thought of an easier way?
It's the most valuable thing in the world. It's not cheap. I mean, it's the most valuable thing in the world. So, we need to better pay a price for that.
Yes. Yes. Did you want to say something?
We already got a fairly high self-opinion. And if Krishna made it easy for us, then it would just inflate that and then reduce the qualification to actually love them.
Yes? One and then the other.
Krishna kind of easily gives some kind of blessings, but by giving this Krishna prema, he actually gives himself. So
it's a very, very big thing. And actually, one of the qualities of Bhava Bhakti, there are two specific qualities of Bhava Bhakti. One is Sudolava, and the other is Moksha Lagudakrit. So Moksha Lagudakrit means that Bhava Bhakti, it makes the pleasure that one gets from liberation appear completely insignificant. Completely insignificant. And Bhava Bhakti is just like a drop of the ocean of prema. So gives us a glimpse of the power of prema. Of bhava, what to speak of prema. And sudolabha, of course, means what?
Rare.
It's rare and very. Labha means what? To gain. And durlabha means difficult to gain. And sudolabha increases it even more. It's extremely difficult to obtain. So Srila Jiva Goswami explains why it's so difficult. And there are two reasons. And one of them is,
even after many, many sadhanas, you cannot obtain it. And the other is,
Mataji? No?
And I heard the second is Krishna may not give it because he gives himself away with this.
So he wants to increase our desire. Because he himself is purchased by the love, by prema bhakti. He himself is purchased by bhava bhakti. So one doesn't give oneself cheaply. What to speak of Krishna doing that? So someone has to actually be extremely... So someone has to be extremely desirous, extremely pure, and only want to love Krishna. Tatraloya mapimuya ekalam. This is the one price. So why it's difficult is only because we're bahushaka. But many branched in our desires, and I think everyone really said this in their own way, because the most valuable thing has to be purchased with a very single-pointed desire, because it is so powerful, love for Krishna, that it conquers Krishna. And Krishna sandrandananda visheshatma, Krishna akarshani, it attracts Krishna, controls Krishna. It gives pleasure beyond anything. So such a thing has to be purchased by one commodity, and that is pure, pure, pure love. And therefore the abhideya tattva, the process, is what is the abhideya tattva? What is the abhideya? What is the process of obtaining Krishna? Yes and no. It is a special kind. It's kevala bhakti. It's akantiki bhakti. It's pure devotional service. Not mixed devotional service. But not only that, it's spontaneous devotional service. This is the process of obtaining Goloka Vrindavan. Of course, Krishna has to give himself. So the ordeal, there's two sides of it. One is the purifying side. We really have to only want one thing, because it's so pure and valuable. And the other side is Krishna withholds it, giving it. It is nothing we can just get by our own power. Krishna has to give it. And Krishna withholds it, so that our desires increase. I want it. I want to want anything else. I can't live without it. Oh, Krishna, Hare Krishna. And some of us, I can see sometimes myself, that, you know, certainly I want to be a devotee, certainly I want to be in Goloka Vrindavan. And then when on both sides, my mind will want other things as well, and that completely takes over my whatever desire, small desire I have to be an actual devotee. It's completely eclipsed by my material desires. Krishna doesn't get caught by that. And the other thing is, when I don't get what I want, I turn around and go the other way mentally. I seek my pleasure in my life somewhere else. So Krishna's watching on these two sides. What do you really want? And I say, oh, I want you, Krishna, your service. And he says, oh, really? Let's see. Let's see. And therefore, Narottama Das Thakur says, this prema bhakti is like gold purifying 1,000 flames, 10,000 flames. Yeah. That means when gold is melted in the process of purification, then maybe some impurities rise to the top, and those impurities are taken away. And then it's melted again, purified in the second flame. And then some more impurities, more subtle impurities, come to the top, and they have to be taken away. And then again, so 10,000 times, so that there's actually no impurities left, no Anya Abhilas. What does Anya Abhilas mean? Other desires. No other desires. None. Nothing. Sunya. Sunya. No, I only want this. Have no other shelter, so it is rare. It is rare. So the ordeals aren't inherent in the material level for us aspiring devotees. The ordeals are part of the purification to remove extraneous things and to increase our desire. That's what the ordeals are. But if we just remain fully fixed, if we were pure, there's no ordeals. And therefore, Prabodhananda Saraswati Thakur says, Vishwa Purna Sukhayate, the universe is a happy place, full of happiness only. And I saw Prabhupada one time in 1976 in Fiji. He was just sitting back. And he was saying, in the beginning days, there was no anxiety. And now there's also no anxiety. And this is after he went through fighting for Juhu and fighting this and this leader doing this and this disaster and this happening and conspiracies. There's no difficulties. Because difficulties come when we are not focused on what we want. When we only want one thing, indeed, there are no difficulties. Our whole life force, our whole energy is fixed. One. Yavya satmita buddhi ekeha. Okay, so that was my question. Maharaj? The magic basket has appeared.
Okay.
With very serious questions.
So I suggest the following. First, we need to open the doors and the windows because we need to have oxygen. The breathing is. It will be a little ordeal to have the. Cold air, but it is purifying us. So the second thing is something which I will say mostly to myself and to Bhujan Prabhu. There are now about 20 questions, 30 questions, 40 questions, and we want to answer as many questions as possible. So I request myself and Bhujan Prabhu, we really have to be focused. We really have to maybe eat some chili and we will try our best. So the magical question has arrived, but I want to say one thing. What you explained was really such a good introduction to this morning. Bhujan Prabhu, with this ordeal and the gold which has to be purified 100 times, very amazing view, perspective. Good, so let us start. Bhujan Prabhu, you will have the first chance.
No.
Should I go?
The basket is in your lap.
My lap, okay. I found this one. Hare Krishna. When progressing in devotional life, Maya throws many things to pull us back. Intelligence knows it's a block, but mind wants it for instant enjoyment. How to be saved in all circumstances? Whoever wrote this question, you have written very nicely. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur informs us of the prayer of the awakening soul. The awakening soul says, I have nothing to do with you, my dear body, and I have nothing to do with you, my mind. That means that the desires of body and mind are not my desires. I totally understand this, and I refuse to be a slave anymore. So, to be saved in all circumstances, when your mind and your body go in one direction, and you understand, this brings me, by your intelligence, you understand, this brings me only to Maya. This is only possible if you understand that you are the soul. As long as you remain on the mental platform, that means identified with your mind, and as long as you remain on the physical platform, that is, you remain identified with the hunger and thirst and lust and everything which develops in the physical body, you will not be able to pull back. Therefore, proper spiritual life begins with the understanding, I'm a soul, I have different desires. And I would recommend you, who has asked this question, how to be saved in all circumstances, to start a serious practice starting today or latest tomorrow. Whenever you get up, you need to become aware for a second or so that you are an eternal soul. You need to practice it. You need to make it a practice now. Otherwise, you will never understand it and you will never be able to understand Krishna consciousness. It will only be a mental impression and an hallucination. So, to really understand I'm an eternal soul needs practice like anything else. It means a sadhana. And one of the items is to just practice awareness every day about that you are an eternal soul. I'm presently organizing a retreat where I want to bring people to the level where they can understand their eternal soul by meditations, by confronting death, by regularly reading particular passages from the Shastras, and by understanding the Puranjana analogy, not theoretical but practical, so that this can happen. Hare Krishna. First question. Puridham Prabhu, please. Pick a question.
During my first few rounds of chanting, I consciously make an effort to bring the mind back to hearing the mantra and the levels ABC you spoke of. But as rounds go by, my mental muscles become exhausted and I am unable to pull the mind back as often. Doesn't seem exactly to be a question attached to that, but I assume the question is,
what to do?
What to do? Well, since whoever wrote this used the mental muscle example, will answer it by continuing that metaphor. So if we don't use our muscles, what happens to them? They lose all their strength. You either use it or lose it. So because we're not practiced to controlling our mind, it's very, very extremely difficult and to do so. And even a small attempt after a few rounds, we feel tired. Just like in the beginning when one is doing some exercises and one's muscles aren't strong, just a little exertion makes us feel tired. But after a while, we gain strength. And the muscles, by lifting the weights again and again, regularly, day after day, the muscles actually become stronger. So in this example, what we have to do, obviously, is continue. That's the most important principle, is to continue and never stop and never give up. And keep a hope always that help will come from above. Two small points in this. We know the Puranic story of the little sparrow who the Prabhupada puts in the Bhagavad Gita, as it is in one of its purports. The little sparrow who decided she was going to what?
Dry up
the ocean. A very difficult task for a little sparrow, beak by beak. And then, and this is the example of the determination that is required in spiritual life. I'm going to do it despite the fact that it is practically speaking beyond my capacity. And that type of determination on behalf of the sparrow attracted the attention of none other than Garuda. So this is ultimately our hope. We try our best to strengthen our muscles and listen to the Hare Krishna mantra. And then our ultimate hope is that Krishna will see the determination of our effort, the parisrama, in the words of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, our hard work and endeavor, and then give us, sprinkle some drops of mercy upon us, and then it becomes easy. So I've seen, and this is the second concluding point, I've seen, sometimes, and devotees yesterday explained this to me, told me that they're chanting and chanting and struggling and struggling, and probably everyone has this experience, and suddenly, it's so easy to chant. It's not exactly our struggle that has made it easier to chant. Yes, I've done it so well, and now I can do it. Because then, it can be gone like that too. That's the Garuda of Krishna's mercy coming to us. We should never be proud of it, but it doesn't, because it's mercy, it's given to us, but we should know without the struggle, our attempt, there is no inclination on Krishna's part to give us his mercy. So that would be my answer.
Wonderful.
Just keep going. Most important thing. In good association.
Wonderful, wonderful. The next question says, Pamho AGTSP. Is there anything Srila Prabhupada, Shastra, tradition on chanting japa for the benefit of others? For example, for devotees in Srila Prabhupada's marathon, etc.
I'm sorry, could you read that again?
Yes. Is there anything in Srila Prabhupada's writing, in the Shastra, or in tradition, on chanting japa for the benefit of others? For example, for devotees in Srila Prabhupada's marathon. What I know in answer to this question is that you cannot really do devotional service for someone else. Devotional service needs to always be done by the person himself, because the basis on which devotional service stands is motivation, a favorable mood to please Krishna. So that is something which an individual himself must bring up and not another person. But at the same time, it is said that a devotee can pray for others and that Krishna will listen to the prayer of such a devotee. So you can't exactly do chant rounds for someone else, and then it's the same thing that as if this person has chanted rounds. But what you can do is to benefit others, is to pray to Krishna that please help the Sankirtan devotees during the Prabhupada marathon. I always prayed in Germany that please Krishna reduce the coldness. And I do not know, but sometimes devotees said this was a warm winter. I don't claim it is because of my prayers, but I know you can do that. That is my answer. Burija.
Thank you. You think you can get rid of the fog? No, that you wouldn't want to do in Vrindavan. No, sorry. Radhe, Radhe.
Wonderful.
How is it possible to overcome our doubts in our spiritual life? Thank you very much, your ever servant. I recently heard Prabhupada say in a lecture, obviously an older lecture, he said that we have a right, when we have doubts, we have a right to ask questions. It is not that doubting in and of itself is something that we should feel bad about, because it's natural. It's natural. Doubting is a function of the intelligence. So we can ask questions about the specific doubts. In addition, and Prabhupada actually said you have a right to do it. In addition, just as darkness is removed by the addition of light automatically, doubts are removed by increase of faith. And faith is increased by hearing Shastra and the association of devotees. So that would be my answer to that. Would you like to add anything on that one?
Oh, that's a classical question, which is... I really would like to say one sentence. I have always experienced in my own spiritual life that the doubts become removed when you change the level of your perception, the level of your experience, the level of your realizations. And for instance, coming here to the Holy Dham changes our level entirely. And then what was a problem on one level is very easily seen as something unproblematic on another level. It's solved. The sun has risen and the fog is gone.
So that answer means to raise one's consciousness.
To raise one's consciousness, yeah. Thank you for... Yes, to raise one's consciousness. See, when you are in the cellar, you have cellar consciousness and see darkness all around. But if you... to to clarify doubts, in other words, is not just an intellectual process. You can pour as much knowledge as you want into the head of someone. If he remains on the level where he is presently, he will perceive as he presently perceives. So let him make advancement by changing or upraising the consciousness. I think that is very important dimension.
Yes.
I'm really getting awake, Bhurijan Prabhu. This is a good. This is so nice to answer question. What is recommended? Chanting loudly, softly, or very softly? Should one keep one's eyes closed or opened during japa? Thank you. This is very, very pragmatic question. Srila Rupa Goswami in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says that japa should be done is a soft utterance. Kirtan is a loud chanting, but japa is a soft utterance. With soft utterance, you have to bring, or eventually you will bring in two powerful items in the japa. One is sound vibration. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, it's a vibration. And because it's soft, you have to concentrate your mind and be there with your mind. So both the tongue and the mind are engaged in soft utterances. In chanting loudly, sometimes only the tongue is engaged. Therefore, Prabhupada once said to a devotee who cannot concentrate, he has to go on the field and chant louder than his mind. Hare Krishna, really loud, to scream out the mind or scream over the mind. That can be done in situations, but do it when no one is around who gets disturbed. Yes. Or the other means is to chant very softly, in fact so soft that it is a chanting of the heart. In this chanting, what you do is you really are chanting with your mind and only, and you have no real audible sound vibration. So the middle, where you have sound vibration and you have the mind, is by Rupa Goswami's standards explained to be the definition of japa. It's called Upangsu chanting. That is also Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur's purport to that Chaitanya Bhagavatam shloka, where Lord Chaitanya tells his beloved devotees of Navadvip to chant. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur says this chanting should be done in the Upangsu style, that is very soft utterances. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Sometimes those who cannot concentrate their mind find this difficult. And for them it's recommended for everyone really to attend kirtan, where you chant very loudly and the vibration goes inside. Should one keep one's eyes closed or on the first point? But really whatever works best is ultimately to be done. Bhurijan Prabhu read us a very nice and I found very important quote the other day, where Srila Prabhupada mentioned that everything is all right, even thinking japa, isn't it? Or
chanting, Mahamantra in your mind.
Chanting Mahamantra in your mind. Yeah? But the real thing is that you can pay total attention to the holy name. And at different times you might do different things. We hear that Haridas Thakur chanted his mantras in first very loud, the first 64 rounds, the second set of 64 rounds in the Opangsu style, and the last in the Manasik style, just meditating. Mm-hmm. Should one keep one's eyes closed or opened during japa? Here also, it is generally said that one, when doing meditational activities, you have them half closed and you fix the dhriti. Dhriti means the seeing, and you fix it here in this area. See, now I don't look at you. I look now at a point which I had previously designed for the with a finger. It's about here. And this is how the mind becomes totally still. When I look now around you, I might become caught up and by some of your interesting facial expressions and so on and so forth. So this is a general yoga practice to keep it and have a little closed. However, yoga is not, we don't perform bhakti or yoga mishra bhakti, bhakti performed with yoga. If that helps you, this general advice which is given for yogis, do it. But otherwise you can do whatever helps. Sometimes to fix the eyes on the deities is mentioned as fixing the mind, or a picture that is mentioned, or fixing the eyes on the holy name as it is written down, that is mentioned. That helps our concentration. Sometimes you can close your eyes when you're overcome with loving emotions and you see something in your heart and you feel, if I open my eyes, I will be distracted from that what I see for a moment in my mind. There are, in the Sanat Kumar Sanghita, there are two scenes which are described which we should visualize on. One is to see Radha and Krishna under a kadamba tree, surrounded by the sakis who praise them. And the other, a very nice meditation, is to see Radha and Krishna in the Yamuna, splashing each other joyfully with water. It is a scene. It comes on one of the coming level retreat, japa retreats. We will hear about meditations while doing japa. Bhujan Prabhu and myself intend to give the japa retreat on different levels, level A, B, and C. So here I will not speak about something which in great detail. You have to come again. Hare Krishna. But yes, generally it is said for beginners they should be careful to not close the eyes because of sleep. But sometimes when we are overcome so much with good Krishna conscious emotions, then it is certainly all right to close the eyes, because when the emotions are there, you can't fall asleep. Usually first the mind falls asleep and then the body falls asleep. So when the mind is alert, it doesn't fall asleep. There's no sleep.
Can I add one little?
Please do.
That keeping the eyes open or closed, as Maharaj is saying, that's whatever works. But instead of thinking in such an external way, we should try and listen to the holy name. And then whether the eyes... What I've seen is that most people, when they're actually listening, trying to concentrate, their eyes just naturally close. Mm-hmm. But don't think about whether I see my eyes open or closed. Think about in wrapping one's consciousness around the sweet, holy name of Krishna. Mm. Should I pick a difficult question or an easy one?
A medium, I would say.
Okay. Who is Bhakti Devi? Who is Bhakti Devi?
You ask me? Bhakti Devi is an expansion of Srimati Radharani.
What should we do when devotees do Vaishnava and Guru criticism all the time? What should we do when devotees criticize... I'll translate it. What should we do when devotees criticize Vaishnavas and Gurus all the time? When we live in the association of such devotees? Well, the answer is obvious, that either they should stop or you should leave. And how to get them to stop is more difficult. The first thing is that we should make sure that we don't do that. I've told devotees about the Kartik Vrat that I once took. When in Vrindavan, the devotees were all taking Kartik Vrats and giving up sweets and chanting a few extra rounds or reading a little bit more or getting up a little early. So one devotee said to me, why don't you do something interesting this year? Instead of doing those kind of rites, why don't you take the vow in Kartik to not criticize any devotees? And I thought, oh, what a great idea. So I said, I took that as my vrata, that I, for the month of Kartik, I shall not criticize. And what happened to me was quite shocking. Is that I became conscious of how continuously I was criticizing devotees in an offhanded way. Just always, oh, this one's like this, and this one's like that.
What means offhanded?
Offhanded means casually, without even, you know, not even being angry or not even being serious. Just saying bad things about devotees. And I've seen also that when one does do that, when one criticizes or minimizes devotees, you can actually feel it. We won't do an experiment on this right now, an experiential learning. But if you criticize devotees or anyone practically, you feel that your heart goes like this.
Yeah.
At least I feel that. So what happened? First of all, my vrat lasted 2 days. I completely failed because I became so conscious of all the times how much I criticized the devotees. Even during those 2 days, I just had to give up. And it was so embarrassing, but so instructive to me how casually, offhandedly I do that, and how detrimental that is for my own Krishna consciousness. So the first thing is to make sure we don't do this ourselves. This is actually the aparads, Vaishnava aparad, will continue life after life carrying the results of that, and the results are horrible. Pride in devotional service, duplicity in devotional service, lack of faith, and attachment to things that are against devotional service. These are very much the result of aparad, Vaishnava aparad. So we should understand the great danger of this. Oh, I have this quotation from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Oh, it's so heavy on this point. Unfortunately, I can't... maybe I could pick another one. Maybe it's going to be that.
The quote?
Maybe. But probably not. he says something to the effect of, he explains what he means, because you know we always hear that Prabhupada saying that when you get up in the morning, you should beat your mind with a shoes, and then when you go to sleep at night with broomsticks, like that with a broom. So he, in this quotation, or in this, he explains what he means. And also I found out recently, there is another part to that, that his suggestion, there's something very positive attached to that. Not only just beat your mind, but also you know, remember holy people. But another time I'll explain that one when it's on the tip of my tongue, so to speak. But in any case, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura, in this one quotation, he explains what exactly he means by beating your mind with shoes and broomsticks. And he said, you should criticize your mind. You should criticize yourself. You rascal mind, you know better than anyone else what kind of a person you are, and you have the nerve to criticize others? You have the nerve to criticize others considering what your qualities are, and you know that better than anyone else? You should find fault, and this is to quote, you should only find fault with your own damn mind, he says.
Krishna.
It's much more powerful, his words, more powerful than my rendition of it. So that understanding is required. Who am I to be judging everyone else? And this is just the conditioned consciousness of the false ego trying to place me above everyone else. Who am I to criticize others? I know better than anyone else what goes on inside me. And I'm criticizing others? So this is the false ego at its worst. So the first principle I would say in this is make sure, understand how dangerous this mentality is. The second principle is don't do it ourselves. First principle is really get a deep understanding how Vaishnava Aparat ruins everything in our spiritual life. Bahu janma kodi yadi shravana kirtanam tabu tat tabat napaya krishna prema dana napaya. We will not be able, because of offenses, even if we chant for many, many births, bahu janma kodi, even if we chant for many births, we will not get Krishna Charan, the lotus feet of Krishna, or Prema Dana, the wealth of love, because of this aparadha. So first thing is understanding. Second is, I have to stop this. And really, really try and stop it. And pray to Krishna for help. And third thing is, Maybe this is a good topic for istagostis and talking amongst the devotees so that we understand how bad it is. And then the fourth principle is that then you have to talk to the person one time and say, excuse me, I'm such a fallen soul. I know better than anyone else that my heart is full of the worst kind of things. So please forgive me, but I don't want to hear this kind of thing. It's just so bad for my Krishna consciousness. Just like a guest passing through when a guest is in somebody's house, they don't get involved in the family quarrels and how, you know, if this is clean and that's dirty. This is not the business of a guest. The guest just smiles at everything and sees the good. So similarly, at some point you have to say to the person, excuse me, I'm not, you don't say I'm criticizing you or anything, but this is just bad for my consciousness. Please, please be kind to me. I don't want to hear these things. I can't do it anymore. I've ruined so much of my spiritual life, so many years speaking in here. I just can't do it anymore. It causes me too much pain. I beg you, please don't pour this in my ear. And then, if it just continues and continues and the people won't stop, And it will be too painful to be there and actually... That's my... Would you like to...
I would like to ask you a question, which I have been asked often, which I feel is a good question about this. Suppose someone has made an offense against a Vaishnav, and now the relationships are strained. They are not what they were before. There's a dark cloud of this misbehavior there. How do you really make up with that Vaishnava in practical terms? We know we have to obtain his forgiveness. How do you get the strain out or the stress out of the relationship? Is it? Do you know what I mean to ask?
I do. But I also find that there's general principle, and then there's specific dealings between two individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And it's without knowing sometimes the specific dealings between two individuals, you have to know this. You have to know the circumstance to offer any advice at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the general principle is. Is something that two little stories really illustrated for me. One is that there was one devotee who had a really big fight with one time, and I never really forgave him, and he was in a position of authority, and I never really forgave him, and then I ended up leaving that temple, and we still remained cordial and polite in dealings. But I was always carrying that in my heart, and not, you know, some resentment.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually that devotee left the movement. And actually I felt terrible, because I wasn't really his well-wisher in my heart. I was carrying a seed, the cloud of revenge was hanging around my consciousness. So I felt really bad. When something bad actually happened to that devotee.
Yeah.
So, and the second thing is that one of the worst things that can happen in our life, in one sense, you have a fight with someone and you think that, oh, you know, I'll take care of it later, and that person dies. And the older we get, this is very real, that it happens. And then there's nothing you can do, practically speaking, because he's gone. So this is something to really keep in mind, is that it's better to deal with these things quickly as possible. There's an old proverb even that says, after years, I can't remember the exact, but the point is that if you bring up an old incident after years, you're bringing up an old wound, and apologies then cause more pain, cause the old wound to be open. So therefore, when something happens, better get it resolved as quickly as possible and remove the cloud through humble submissions. And never mind what the other person has done wrong. And this is another one that I'm really... You can't say in any way, when you're going to apologize to someone, you can't say... I'm really sorry for what I did, even though you really deserved it because of what you did to me. I'm making it very gross, but I find I do this kind of a thing subtly other times. Even though I was more or less justified because what you did, I'm sorry of how I reacted. You made me angry. As if someone could make us angry. That's the way. So... when you go to apologize, the straw has to be between your teeth, and don't carry any extra for them. Just keep one thing at a time. Just do your part. Just do your part.
Thank you.
Can I have a question? What if you think that the other person is wrong? Is it okay for you to say you're sorry?
Do you have anything to be sorry about?
Well, you want to have your relationship together.
No, but do you have anything to be sorry about?
You can just say, we want to get together again.
But do you have anything to be sorry about? Have you done anything wrong?
Well, if you feel that you're wrong, but you're not wrong.
Welcome to the way we all think. Just because I'm so wonderful, I'm going to apologize to you.
Just feel a little bit something is wrong, but the other person is more wrong than you.
But that's what I'm saying.
See?
Have you done anything wrong?
Maybe.
Well then, until you make up your mind, don't apologize.
But maybe you did something wrong.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Decide whether it's maybe or you did. If you decide that maybe I did something wrong, you'll have a very insincere apology and no one will believe you. The person won't believe you.
So you better just keep going.
No, first decide whether you did something wrong. How can you apologize sincerely for something?
Yeah, because you made the other person hurt, maybe, but...
Okay.
Then that's...
So, but first examine... This is my... First you examine yourself. Could I have done this better? Or how are my motivations when I did it? And this is something that managers have to deal with. It's so difficult. One of the reasons it's difficult to be a manager is because your service is to correct people a lot of the time. So before you do that, you check and see whether or not your interest is for the person. In other words, if you get affection in your heart for the person, and then if you correct them, it's completely different than if you're angry at the person with no affection in the heart. So when you think, maybe just like a child, when you're dealing with your own child and correcting them, naturally you're thinking about what's their welfare. So you correct them with affection, and the affection balances out. And it dictates the nature of how you correct them. So, ideally and properly, we should have affection when we correct others and be thinking of their welfare. And one thing that's so, I think it's worthy of being said in this day and age, it's not everyone's business to correct everyone else. If it's your position, your service, we're only servants. So if it's our service to correct another, then we do it. If not, we should mind our own business. Or bring it to the attention of a person who it is their business. And then that person's duty is to have part of it. They're taking care of them. They're taking care of those people. So therefore, they naturally have affection. Respect for them. So that should govern. So if I have corrected someone in my anger, even though the person has done wrong, you can't apologize for what they've done wrong, but you can apologize if you understand that my consciousness wasn't right when I did that. So if I've hurt you, I didn't mean to hurt you. I wanted to point something out to you. But I saw my consciousness wasn't actually right. I'm sorry for my consciousness. So I think... Yeah, one has to be introspective. Do you want to?
No, you have very nicely expressed. Very nice. Yeah, these are very practical and very, very important subjects. If we wish our japa to rise, we have to really work on this Vaishnava apparat and avoid it. It's a very deep question. Jananam, we can talk about this in private. I will tell you something which I'm afraid to tell in the public. I mean, one thing is sure, insincere apologies don't make it to the heart and don't solve anything if you are not really, if you can't, if one cannot see that one has done anything wrong. Maybe sometimes it helps to ask, please tell me, I feel I did maybe something wrong, but I'm not aware. Can you please tell me? You know, that sometimes helps to get the communication going. Hare Krishna. Here's the next question. When is it appropriate to increase the number of rounds? When is it not? There are natural times when it's always appropriate, even if it's not yet your level, so to say. And that is the Ekadasi days. They are reserved so that we put more into Harikatha and more into glorifying Krishna. That's where you can get a feel for the increasing of rounds. Or during the when you are in the Holy Dham, in Vrindavan Dham, Mayapur Dham, it is always said that this is the time when you should increase your rounds. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that Dham means Nam, and Nam brings you to calm. And this calm is, calm means desire, or in an increased way, calm means lust, but here it means Krishna calm, the desire or the plan of Krishna. When you go to the holy name and you increase the number of your rounds, when you go to the holy Dham, I wanted to say, and you increase the number of your rounds to please Krishna, you know you are always right, and it brings you to the level where you will be able to do what is Krishna's desire. My dear devotees, we need to come to the level of Krishna Kam, the level where we surrender to Krishna's plan. Now we are fully surrendered to our mind's plan. Whatever happens, yip-ping, yes, we think that's what we should do. You're wrong. That's what a stranger wants you to do, your mind. The Dham is always a place where you should increase your rounds. It's said sometimes that we go to the Dham, or sometimes devotees go to the Dham, and they become so much involved in their mental reactions to the Dham, you know, a cultural fascination, or their shopping list, which they need to fulfill, or you know, this or that. No, when you are in the Dham, sit down for the Nam, and then you will get ready for Krishna Kam, for the plan of Lord Krishna. So, when is it not appropriate to increase one's round? It is not appropriate to increase your rounds when the rounds get into a stressful situation and you are really just fighting it through. What you should fight through in all cases is your vow. When you take an initiation vow of 16 rounds, then this is what you should always do. Only in very rare cases you can postpone the rounds to the next day, which you have not been able to chant on that one day. It shouldn't become a habit. So after you have completed your number of rounds, then if you feel that chanting now more rounds, I will just develop an antipathy against the holy name. That will be the result. I will just resist so much, then better to stick to the number of your rounds. See, it's not so very important to increase numbers and numbers of rounds without any taste for Krishna. What is the use? It's a counting game only, says Bhaktivinoda Thakur. The chanting of rounds must be done. Your vrata you must do somehow or other, even if it is a counting game. But that is your numbers which you take the vow for. But the increase of rounds will come with taste. I know the Prabhupada wanted his disciples to increase their rounds. And there are many quotes which are now not with me. They are printed down in the manuscript of yet another new book of the Holy Name. Yes, this is what I want to say. Is it? I hope it is clear. Thank you. But I must say, passing the basket now on to Bhujan, these are very nice questions, isn't it? Do you also practical. Feel like this? Yes.
Practical.
So sincere, yes.
And nice answer. Unnecessary austerities make the heart hard, and hence difficult to call out to Krishna. My question is, how does one distinguish between an actual unnecessary austerity and a trick of the mind that uses austerity makes the heart hard as an excuse to avoid even necessary austerities? It seems to me that the question answers itself.
Could you repeat the question for simple-minded people like me?
Unnecessary, or in other words, how do you tell the difference? Because austerities make the heart hard. How do you tell the difference between a true austerity that's required and an austerity that will make the heart hard, in essence. So I think that it's just by using the word necessary austerities, that just getting up early, for example, is considered a necessary austerity. Following the four rules is considered a necessary austerity. Actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about austerity of the mind, austerity of the different types of austerities. Some of them are very, very simple, and they fit so naturally into the Krishna conscious program. And if one tries to avoid those austerities because they are indeed necessary to make advancement, if we want to make advancement, they are necessary, then trying to avoid them will hinder our making advancement. If there are unnecessary austerities, it would be good to ask the person, what do they mean by unnecessary austerity? Because we can make it silly, like, you know, standing on one leg, or, you know, surrounding ourselves with fires in the middle of the hot sun in Vrindavan in the summer, or taking bath in ice water in Gomuk, in the Himalayas, in the winter. So that would be an unnecessary austerity, which are by definition unnecessary. And the necessary austerities, as we were saying, necessary that are prescribed automatically, are necessary. But without really knowing what the questioner has in mind, it's a little hard for me to speak more than something. We shouldn't go out of our way to perform austerities. We should go out of our way to please Krishna, put Krishna in the center. And the things that are difficult for us, that our mind pleasure-seeking mind might wish to reject, but it's pleasing to Krishna, and it's our particular service, we should do those. Yes?
Prabhu, it's not my question, but I had a thought regarding this, like Ekadashi. Some people do Nirjal Ekadashi, some people fast from grains, some people just fast completely. So, you know, which one's necessary and which one's unnecessary?
I don't think that's a question of necessary or unnecessary. That's a question of what our capacity is to perform austerities. Some people, if they perform, if they don't neither drink water nor eat on an Ekadasi, they will simply sleep because of lack of energy. And other people have naturally a lot of prana energy, and they can do that, and they can maximize their chanting. So the real principle in that example, for example, of Ekadasi, is to maximize one's spiritual engagements and to minimize naturally one's material engagements, such as the eating and sleeping. But if minimizing the material interferes with maximizing the spiritual, then that's an unnecessary, it's against devotional service, practically speaking. So one has to understand the principle. Maybe, do we have time for one more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on what it's not.
One point, right after, we should discuss a little bit, Will, about the...
Where we will go. At the moment, Radharani has placed a whitish cloud over us. So, I would suggest just to keep. I mean, it's such a nice session, actually. Maybe we should take prasad. Is prasadam ready? This is the first question. It is ready.
Just now getting ready.
Just now getting ready. This. The Lord eats. So it is ready. So it is ready. Then maybe you feel we should stop here? And
why don't you just answer one more question? But make it a
the best question.
No, they're all best questions. But make it the question that will end the class just properly.
Oh, Krishna.
Question and answer session.
Krishna. This
it's
is a letter. It's a wonderful. Hare Krishna, before anything else, let me convey my sincere appreciation and gratitude for your honest and open verbalization of your own struggles and ordeals in the pursuit of spiritual enrichment. It inspires frankness in us and strengthens our confidence in you and your instructions. This must apply to Burijan Prabhu, because it makes you so much more real as people. Thank you. Both of us, I think, were very thankful. Yes, we want this retreat to be something real. In Bhajan Rahasya, I think now comes the question, Thakur Bhaktivinoda writes that in the beginning, for some days, one should engage in the chanting of the holy names according to the first shloka of Shikshastaka, and then continues to say that by this practice, one should then become mature, as described in the second verse, by carefully trying to avoid nama-aparad, indicated by the word durdevam. He seems to indicate a rather rapid development. Yes, I also noted that. I know from personal experience that 20 years in the movement does not necessarily mean 20 years of sensible and diligent spiritual practice. Do you believe that with sufficient education and training and a careful and serious approach on the part of a candidate, a practitioner
could arrive to your present level of realization and practice within, within a shorter amount of time. Wonderful, wonderful. You write so, so much. So, then comes another question, and a nice. Yes. So, let me summarize it. Srila Thakur Bhaktivinoda gives a rapid path in the Shikshas, in the Bhajan Rahasya, where he really says it's really there that for a few days you practice according to the first level of that is with faith. You practice with faith, and after a few days you progress to chanting in maturity. That means giving up the offenses and the anattas, and then in a few more days you go verse by verse. It seems you obtain love of Godhead.
In 2 weeks.
In two weeks minimum.
We have a seminar starting next month. How to attain love of Godhead in 2 weeks?
Yeah. And now the justified question is: do you think it can go fast? Can a new devotee come very fast to a high level of Krishna consciousness? My dear devotees, I think it is possible if you learn three words: desire, eagerness, and the third word, anxiety. Let me make this mystical answer clear. Once Srila Prabhupada was on a morning walk, and the morning walk was completed, he was already in his car, and Shruta Kirti, who told me this, was just closing the car door when one of Srila Prabhupada's disciples...
Excuse me, say that again. I coughed.
Yes. So when Srila Prabhupada had finished his morning walk and was already in the car, and the car door was closed, then one of his disciples, who had been on this morning walk, but who hadn't asked a chance to ask a burning question, stepped forward. Now, it was an awkward moment. The car engine was almost started, and the car was moving, but this devotee really had a question, and he had to ask it now. Prabhupada, can I ask the question? Prabhupada looked at him, and he must have seen the urgency within the eyes of the devotees, and he nodded. Prabhupada, what is necessary to become Krishna conscious? He meant full Krishna conscious. Prabhupada looked at him and gave his one word answer: desire. Then the car engine started. Prabhupada must have looked in. Is it all right? The devotee was fully satisfied, and the car went off to the morning greeting. At another time, in a famous lecture, Prabhupada speaks about eagerness as the only price to develop Krishna consciousness. He says, if you want to become Krishna conscious, you have to become eager. Lolyam. I have coined this phrase, Krishna consciousness, after this verse, Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavita Mati. It's the shloka which says, the only price for Krishna consciousness is eagerness. A third time, I will bring these three points together in a moment. don't try to figure it out now on yourself. It takes on a third occasion. It was in a morning walk in Hawaii. The waves were just very nicely coming on the beach. Prabhupada was walking in the fresh morning air, surrounded by his sannyasi disciples, and one of them asked them, "Prabhupada, how do we become Krishna conscious?" And he said, "By your anxiety." And then he said, "Just like Mother Yashoda. Mother Yashoda was always so anxious for Krishna's well-being." And we all know what Mother Yashoda's anxiety means. You know, Mother Yashoda comes when Krishna leaves the village of Vrindavan. She comes with Krishna and says, and does any last improvements on the dress, you know, while Krishna's already walking with his coward boys. And then he says, "It's all right, go. You can go back to the village." And but Mother Yashoda stops, but then she sees Krishna and he thinks, "Has he eaten enough? His stomach is so slim." So again she comes forward and gives a sweet. Krishna says, "All right, Mother, I have eaten." And then she falls back again, sees Krishna, and again another anxiety comes. What if a demon is there? And she runs forward and she says to the cowherd boys like Bhadrasen and Angshu, "Protect my little boy. He doesn't know where his borders are. Protect him. You go before him. You go to each side. You go in the back with sticks. Protect him." Again, Mother Yashoda falls back. And another anxiety overcomes her. She runs forward. But Kanai, how can you go outside? The sun is rising. It will be too hot for you. "No, no, no, no," said, "there are shaded trees who give shade. No problem for me." "But the pebbles and the stones and the thorns for your soft lotus feet." "No, no, Mother. There are these deers, these Krishnasara deers, who with their tails sweep the path. It's very, very nice. It's very comfortable." And this time, finally, Mother Yashoda stays back. She is so anxious. Prabhupada didn't explain these stories in the morning walk. It was just meant as an illustration for Mother Yashoda's anxieties. But Prabhupada then continued. He said, "The problem is you are always anxious for yourself." "Oh, will I get enough prasadam? Will I get enough attention and recognition? Will this work so that I'm in peace of mind?" This is a problem of the conditioned soul. So to become Krishna conscious, three things are required, which are actually only one thing: desire, eagerness, and this type of anxiety for Krishna, which is an anxiety to serve Krishna, are really only desire at different temperatures. For instance, in this thermos, this is now empty, but usually there is boiling hot water. In this cup, there is cool water. And here, because it stands a lot in the cold morning air, it's ice-cold water, unfit for any person over 50 years to drink. So it starts with desire, but it's all water at different temperatures. So desire, eagerness, and anxiety for Krishna's service, this must work, this must go, are all the same. And in different degrees. And if you can enter this school of desire and then bring it to the eagerness platform, make it warm, and finally to the boiling stage, be in anxiety, "Oh, Krishna must be satisfied, Krishna must be served." Then you are in Vrindavan consciousness. Then you are there. Then you have attained it. And some of you might have boiled the water in a previous life, I'm very convinced that some of you, the way you have chanted and the way you have gone through your japa retreat, you have already been on this path in a previous life. You have tried to boil your water or make it warmer at least. So you have come with a certain temperature into this life. Now boil it further until it becomes anxiety to serve Krishna. And then you are Krishna conscious. You know, Vrindavan consciousness means everyone just wants to serve Krishna. In all the four rasas which you find in Vrindavan, everyone is just thinking for the pleasure of Krishna, not for their own pleasure. This is the difference to the material consciousness. So thank you very... Bhaktivinoda Thakur seems it goes very... yes, it goes very fast. So I think he's just wishing us well and telling us if you have a strong fire, your water will soon be hot and boiling. So the more fire you bring to your spiritual practice... Well, bhakti is not always causal. It's not a matter of your fire, which often is, when it's misunderstood, something in the mode of passion, which is not the thing. But if Krishna becomes convinced that your desire for him is really at a very hot point, if you can convince Krishna like this, he will give you bhakti and then you have it. But he will look very carefully. I heard this from Mahanidhi Maharaj, and with this I would like to end. Giriraj Parikrama, I told it to the devotees who were on that wonderful midnight parikrama. Do you know why so many people go around Giriraj? Because it's known that he is the best of all the devotees and can fulfill desires. So, when someone goes on Giriraj Parikram, many of the devotees who go back for a child, some biological problem needs to be repaired by Giriraj, many pray for other things. And Giriraj, when someone does Giriraj Parikrama, this is how the Brijbasis say it, it's an analogy, it's a picture, Giriraj goes behind the devotee. And when it's a material desire, Giriraj fulfills it. But when someone prays, I want love for Krishna, Giriraj at that time asked the question which Puri Jam Prabhu has also voiced. Really? Let me see if he still wants this the next year. Then the devotee comes the next year on Govardhan Parikrama. And say the devotee wishes it the next year, then Giriraj becomes inclined and walks behind the devotees. Oh, this is such a good devotee. Let me give him a test and see if his desire is already deep enough. Ow! Why? I did so many Giriraj Parikramas. On this one, I just went on this sharp iron metal bar, and now look, it's bleeding. I know if I go. Thank you. I know India is just too much, you know. I come with my best intentions. I had it, you know, this is too much. And Giriraj stands there and cries. He sees, is it just a momentary, a temperamental expression of frustration, or is it really what's deep inside? If it is deep inside and the devotee wants to turn his face away from Krishna, yes, that's his freedom. But if the devotee says, oh, Krishna, let me take care of this now so that I can... And, thank you, Krishna. Thank you. I must acknowledge I'm a very fallen soul. I have been in Burijan Prabhu's class. He has said gold needs to be burned by the fire of ordeal 100 times. This is now one more time. Fantastic. And in this way, it continues. Girya sends a test. Krishna sends a test. Finally, when the devotee has passed the tests of the Lord, and has been purified, then he gets this. This is my answer. It can be fast. Prabhupada was once asked in Hamburg, how long does it take to come to Krishna consciousness? And he said, it can happen in 1 second, or it may not happen in many lifetimes. It is dependent on this desire, which gets potentiated and comes to eagerness, which gets again potentiated and comes to anxiety for Krishna. Krishna, your pleasure, not my pleasure. Hare Krishna. So, prasadam is ready. Please take your prasadam Burijan Prabhu and Braj Bihari and maybe also Prashanta, we will now have our little gathering, what we will do, then we will announce during Prashadam where we will go next. We have a wonderful ceremony, a concluding ceremony, and the question is only where will we have it, and you will be informed. I wish you a very nice prasadam, and your questions show that you have been very much stirred. What do we do with the other questions? We will read it, Burijan Prabhu and myself, and we will go to Radha Shyam Sunda. I don't know if Burijan Prabhu wants to do it, but I will do it, and I will pray to Radha Shyam Sunda that they give you the answer from within your heart. So you have not posed the question in vain. Hare Krishna.